Welcome to the Guff Man. I'm Alex. With me is James.
Hello, Alex, and listeners.
Hello, James. I already said hello to the listeners. Before we get started, I just wanted to invite you to check out our website, themcguffman.com. We post weekly articles there that we write, and also there are more audio podcasts, video podcasts, and probably something else that I'm forgetting. I don't know. Do we do sketches ever?
Nope. No. We might start
doing stick figures.
Yeah.
Also follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffman, all one word. Send us an email if you have a question, concern, or offended by any of the opinions we have. TheMacGuffman@gmail.com. And if you happen to be on iTunes, or if you want to go to the iTunes store and give us a rating on our actual podcast, that would be great. We put a lot of work into this, and we would love it if more people listened. So tell your friends if your friends are the type of people to enjoy conversations about the conversation or enemy of state. Or if they just like listening to things, monotone gentlemen. Welcome to the government and let's get started. Yeah, okay. I'm through with that.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by Battleship, or as we prefer to call it, a reason to sit in an air-conditioned room for 2 hours. And now, here are Alex and James.
Do it.
Let's.
Do what?
Podcast.
Let's talk about some movies.
Yeah.
Two movies today.
Two movies.
A little combo.
Yep.
Connected in a way I'm sure we'll talk about.
Yeah, it's a good little twofer, I think.
Yeah, two movies I'd never seen until this week, last week.
Two movies I loved a lot.
Yeah, they're good.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Yeah.
me.
I knew.
We are, of course, talking about, of course, like everyone is,
yeah.
The Conversation.
Yep.
1974.
Four.
And Enemy of the State.
That's correct.
1998.
Oh, so you remember that one.
Yeah, that was more recent. I was alive for that one. Two movies kind of dealing with the surveillance technology.
Yep.
Espionage.
Yes.
And two good movies, as we discussed.
Yes.
Yeah. When did you see these first?
I saw Enemy of the State in theaters in 98, and I saw The Conversation for the first time probably in, 2003, 2004.
Okay. Yeah. Enemy of the State, I didn't see it until, as I said, very recently. Mm-hmm. It kind of made a big splash, though.
How do you mean? Like it was a hit.
Yeah, it made $250 million.
Yeah, that was in the period of, from 1996 to, 2003, when Will Smith could be in anything. It would be the biggest hit.
Yeah, but it almost wasn't Will Smith.
That's correct. Who were the other people that it was Mel Gibson up for?
Mel Gibson was one. Tom Cruise?
Yeah. That sounds about right.
Yeah. I could see him in there. How did you like Will Smith in this?
I think he's good.
Really?
I think Enemy of the State's a really well-acted movie in general.
I didn't like him, at all.
I think he's good.
Especially near the start. His first scene, he's establishing his whole lawyer character in the office there.
Yeah.
Ugh. Fine. Just cringed. I really didn't like it. But overall, I really did enjoy the movie. I guess we should start with The Conversation.
Yeah, let's do that.
The first one.
Yeah. That makes sense.
So Gene Hackman.
Yes.
Harrison Ford.
Yes. a very small role.
A very young Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
Very handsome Harrison Ford. Gene Hackman plays... name?
Harry Call.
Harry Call, of course. He is a private investigator, I guess?
Yeah. No, he's more like... he's not so much an investigator as he is just a surveillance man. It's like, this is a thing that I want you to record. He's like, okay. And then he does it.
And he's very well known in his field, very good at what he does.
Yeah, he seems to be the tops of the West Coast surveillance game.
Yeah. And so what's the job he's on for this one?
He has to record a conversation between two people in a square in San Francisco. And that's what happens at the very beginning of the movie. He's to deliver the tapes to the director. We don't really get any more details than that. He'll get $15,000 for it.
Yeah, it's all kind of very cryptic. He doesn't really know what he's doing. He's just recording a conversation.
That's his thing. He doesn't want to know what he's recording. He just tell me what to record and I'll do it.
Yeah, and he even has that line very near the start, which gives you a kind of a good indication of where he's coming from. He says, I don't, because he's talking with his partner there, one of the guys
John Cazale.
Yeah. And John Cazale's very curious as to what they're talking about. And they're kind of just, you know, they're talking about something, but they're not using a lot of details or anything. So even as the viewer, you don't really know what they're talking about. So you're in the same place as him. And he's very curious about, you know, what this, the conversation is all about. And he's bugging Harry Call, Gene Hackman's character, to find out, you know, what this conversation is really about. And Harry says, I don't care what it's about. I just want a big fat recording.
Yep.
So as you said, this really, it's, you know, this is a job for him. He's really not trying to get mixed up. And then later on, we find out that he kind of has a reason not to get too involved with this stuff, right?
Yeah. Well, there was one job that he did, and it appears to be a job that was, you know, it's a job that later on him and a bunch of people in his field are talking about because they all found it very impressive, and they were wanting to know how he pulled it off. Because I think it was a boat.
Yeah.
It was on a boat that was apparently unbuggable, according to the rotund gentleman with the mustache. And it ended up three people got murdered on the job. And
As a result of what he recorded, he handed in the tapes. And then, you know, I guess someone didn't like what was heard. And...
Yeah. So, yeah. So Harry sort of deals with that. And the more he listens to the recording of the conversation in this movie... at the beginning, the more he sort of worries that something similar is going to happen for valid reason.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's, you know, these people are paying a lot of money. There's clearly a lot of stuff invested in this, and it's a very sensitive subject. I mean, the conversation that he's recording, they seem very aware that they could be being recorded.
Yeah.
They go to a public place very deliberately. They walk around in circles. They move in and out of crowds. You know, when he explains to, as you said, the rotund gentleman about how difficult this job was, the conversation in question, the guy throws out, you know, all the ways that he would have done it, and they all get shut down because, yep. You know, oh, you get a lip reader. Oh, but they walk in circles. You need the actual recording of their voices.
You buggy their clothes beforehand. You have no way of telling
what they're going to wear. Yeah. So it's very tough, and they kind of seem to be, you know, on defense, but... He's very good at what he does.
Yeah.
Besides being a very good, I don't know what we're going to call him, recorder?
Yeah, we probably should have looked something up, but surveillance guy.
Yeah, besides being a very good surveillance...
Harry Call, surveillance gentleman.
Surveillance gentleman. What kind of guy is Harry?
Very guarded, I think you could say.
To say the least.
For somebody who makes his living surveilling people, he is paranoid about people doing the same for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's very guarded personally. He doesn't, the person that he's, you know, quasi-dating, he doesn't know anything about him.
Yeah.
Harry, we see it towards the beginning of the movie when he comes home from that opening job. Someone had put a bottle of wine in his apartment for his birthday. And it's his landlord. And one, he's upset that the landlord went into his apartment and is very curious as to how, and so he's calling her like, I want the only key to this apartment. And also he's kind of upset that she knows it's his birthday.
Yeah.
Which she picked out from the mail.
Yes.
By the sounds of things. So yeah, he's very guarded that way. He, almost only makes calls from a payphone.
He says he doesn't even have a home phone at one point.
It certainly seems like nobody has that number to the actual phone that he has.
Yeah. And, you know, as you said about him being, you know, he was very upset that she got into the room and everything. But even in that discussion, when she calls down, you get a very good indication of what kind of person he is. And he's saying, well, why do you need a key to the apartment? I should have the only one. She said, well, what if there's an emergency? What if there's a fire? What if all your personal effects are burnt up? He says, I have no personal effects. Like, I don't have anything. Like, he really seems to have no identity of his own at all. He does his job, and he does it very well, but there's no real life outside of that.
Yeah.
You know, even when he's not on the clock, he's just basically the other end of his job, him defending other people who might, himself against other people who might be recording him the way he records other people.
Yep.
So it's a very, sad existence, kind of very, very guarded. We get a couple indications about how guarded he is too in his workplace there. It's all, it's that wire mesh and it kind of keeps him in. Yeah, it's like a cage, you know, he's got a very caged personality. And the name itself, Harry Call. Do you know the word call outside of the name?
No.
It's like a thin membrane that's on babies when they're born, like a clear, thin membrane that, you know, kind of like I'm not sure exactly, but it, you know, protects them while they're in the womb. And I think that's a very good symbol of who he is. And he's even got that clear white raincoat on all the time. And, you know, I think that is very much representative of a call, like a very thin membrane. You can still see it, but, you know, he's there in every way, but you can't get to him. Like, there's nothing coming in or out. He's there, but again, very, very guarded and very caged. Yep. And that's something we get through the whole movie, and we don't get a lot of character exposition, except for one scene that I really hated. the dream sequence.
Okay.
How did you feel about that one?
I'm fine with it.
Really?
Yeah.
Ugh, not a fan at all.
That's fine.
Okay. Thank you for allowing me to have my how does we've talked about how good he is at his work. How does he kind of feel about his work?
I think formerly, like before the movie starts, I feel like he felt ambivalent. And it's that one job that sort of changed him a little bit, and it's certainly that guilt and fear sort of creeps into him on this job as well. But he takes it very seriously. I don't totally know what you're trying to get out of the question, maybe.
Oh, your opinion.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, no, he takes it very seriously.
Yeah. So. But yeah, I mean, you said he's kind of ambivalent about it.
But it's just like a job. You know?
Yeah, but we know from that previous job where something, you know, where those people died, he is guilty over it.
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and I think this is a very much a movie. I mean, we talked about how paranoid he is, but I think it's a lot about guilt and paranoia. Would you say that's right?
I think that's true. I think it's more about paranoia than it is about guilt. Or at least I certainly think the paranoia is more interesting than the guilt side of things.
Okay.
Because I feel like it's just sort of like, this happened, he's guilty about it. I don't feel like there's much done with it. Okay. It's just sort of, it's the driving force for why he does most of these things, particularly in the second half of the movie. But yeah, I don't think there's like a strong examination of guilt going on in this film.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I see it in the dream sequence a little bit. Like, he has that dream about that girl, and I think he senses something is going to happen to her.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where where this dream comes from, is he's worried about, you know, how his actions are going to affect people.
Yeah. So given how much you love the dream sequence, the guilt, the examination of guilt is your favorite part of the film.
Yeah, yeah, no, clearly. Yeah. No, I do kind of like the examination of, you know, his ideas of guilt and paranoia.
Yep.
And this is a very 70s movie, no?
Yes. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And I really didn't know much about this movie going in, and then I just kind of saw that it was a thriller about... you know, someone in surveillance. So I thought it'd be kind of a spy movie and kind of action-y a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's really not.
Yeah, no, not at all.
It's very slow and quiet. It's much more of a character study than it is an action movie, really.
Well, it's certainly not an action movie, yeah. Again, the stuff I find the most interesting is more to do with the actual conversation than Harry himself.
Okay.
Yes, agreed.
Yeah. What, did you make any... significance of his saxophone playing?
I tried to figure this out. I was extremely surprised to find out that Hackman actually learned how to play saxophone for this movie, because it certainly does not look like he's playing saxophone. I don't know, it has to mean something.
Yeah.
Particularly with the way Coppola worked in the 70s. This movie's written and directed by Francis Ford Coppola, particularly with the way he worked back then, like everything was something.
Yeah.
And he's a very, he's a filmmaker like that. You know, this is the Oranges and the Godfather guy, meaning coming tragedy. I couldn't figure out, there are a lot of things in this movie, as far as symbolism, that I couldn't figure out that I know means something.
Okay.
That I just don't feel like I'm advanced enough to get. Because I do feel like,
okay.
I feel like this is a really great movie that I get 85% of.
Okay.
Yeah,
I don't know. For me, I just, it seemed like his only personal thing at all.
Yep.
We get it right off the, right in the first couple of minutes of the movie. He, you know, we see kind of how empty his apartment is. You know, the white walls, really not much going on. Very solitary life. He's got that one girl that he speaks with. But most of all, he's very, very shut off and does things, you know, very plain and by the book, get these recordings, and that's kind of it. And kind of just lives for his work. And it seems like the saxophone playing is kind of the only thing he does really for himself.
Yeah, I guess it's got to be sort of the thing that makes him a human being.
You know? Yeah, exactly. And when you see him kind of, you know, quell everything about his personality and you know, really just be an agent for whatever work he needs to be hired for and have nothing else, there still is a bit of humanity to him, and he loves, you know, just playing along with his jazz music. And that's right off at the start, we get that. And then at the end, Harrison Ford, Stett, is that his name?
Sure. I would just call him, like, in my head, he's the director's assistant.
Director's assistant, yeah.
By the way, Harrison Ford, the idea of Harrison Ford making Christmas cookies is awesome. And yes, when him and Harry meet the first time, he's like, I have some of my these Christmas cookies I made. They're quite good.
Yeah. Well, yeah, at the end, he says that, you know, after we get to the reveal of what the conversation was really about and everything goes down, the director's assistant calls Harry and says, you know, watch yourself, we're listening. And then what does Harry do?
Tears his apartment apart.
Yeah. Like everything.
Yeah. And yeah, it's this really crazy scene. And at the end, he's just sort of sitting there, just broken, playing a saxophone. And his apartment is ripped to shreds.
Yeah. Like the floor tiles ripped up, yeah. Walls broken.
And like there's this moment where he smashes his, who is it? Mary?
Yeah.
The religious figurine. One of us went to church as a kid, and he smashes that, and that's like a moment. It's like his paranoia is more important than his commitment to God.
Yeah, and I think that's a very, you know, telling sequence about how deep his paranoia has got at this point. And, you know, that would be a decent place to hide it, because I think anyone who's slightly religious kind of feels weird about breaking stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it's kind of, it shows just how deep the paranoia has gone.
Yeah.
His Irish, or not his Irish, but his Catholic guilt is a big part of this movie too, oh, yeah. Along with the whole guilt and paranoia thing we've been discussing.
Which is something I kind of have a hard, like, something about Gene Hackman in this movie, there are some things, like, I have trouble buying. Like, he just doesn't seem like, and I know, I read something when I was researching this that said, Francis Ford Coppola said Hackman struggled with the character because it was so far from what he's like.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd watched the movie a couple times before I read this, and I definitely see that.
Yeah.
I think he's still good in this movie, but, yeah, there's something that doesn't totally fit.
You think Gene Hackman's too kind of personable and jovial?
No, and it's not, like, because he's not personable and jovial in this movie, and the only time he is...
No, but I mean, in real life, and that's why it doesn't quite fit for this character.
I don't know, because I feel like there are elements of Gene Hackman that are more like... Like, he's... I totally buy that he's a very guarded man, just from what I know about Hackman. And, like, certainly a very strong, passionate man. But yeah, there's just something about how timid he is and how meek he is that I just... Something, and I mean, you know, just years and years of watching Gene Hackman movies where he's typecast as a type of person that's not that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just there's just some things in this movie I don't buy Gene Hackman as, but I still love the movie and I still think he's good in it. It's just some parts.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, the end of the very end of the conversation when we're talking about him ripping his apartment apart and the way the camera pans back and forth across his room like a surveillance camera.
That's so cool. Yeah, I thought you'd enjoy that.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff in this movie I enjoy like that.
Yeah, and again, just to go back to that sequence for a second, like the saxophone survives. Like, he dismantles and breaks everything,
yeah.
But there's the saxophone remains, and I think that's, you know, as we were saying before, there's a bit of his humanity there, and I think that even if there's so much guilt and so much paranoia going through you, there still is that shred of humanity at the end, and you still, you know, deep down are a human being who, you know, has weaknesses and enjoys certain things, and yeah. That I think that's what the saxophone's there for in the end. How did you like the reveal of what the conversation was really about?
I think it's awesome.
Yeah, me too. Because I was like, if this whole build up, like, it's called The Conversation, this whole movie, like, how many times do you see that sequence over and over of that conversation?
Yeah.
If there isn't a cool reveal at the end, I'm really going to be disappointed. And yeah. I think it comes together really well when you find out it was them wanting to kill him.
Let's talk about the conversation itself a little bit. Because that's my favorite part of the movie.
I thought your favorite part would be when he's sitting there with, like, the three tapes in the ABC dials.
Oh, I love that part.
I figured you would love that part.
It's
so
awesome. Because I had seen this movie once. Like, I saw it once years ago. And I remember, like, I had to go out of my way to track it down. Like, I went to a third video store or something to find it, just because I don't know if it was a Hackman thing or a Coppola thing. I didn't remember it that well when I was watching it recently. Like, the thing I remembered was the conversation at the very beginning and the very end. But like, as I was rewatching it, like, I mean, that opening shot, I definitely remember that because that's a really cool shot.
The first time they're recording it,
yeah, like the very opening shot of the movie
for the first time,
yeah, and we get that really slow zoom on.
Just, it's like a big crane shot, or maybe not a crane shot, but very, very high up,
it's,
right?
Yeah, and it's a zoom. It's the idea is that it's a point of view shot from one of Harry's workers that he's got up on that tower.
One of the guys with the unidirectional mics, like way up in the window. Yeah,
yeah, and that's a really cool shot, and also the way they shoot the conversation. Itself is really cool. Like, they're using all zoom lenses. They're clearly shooting it from far away.
Yeah.
They're not moving the cam. Like, you know, the idea is they're shooting it like they're surveilling it more than they're
absolutely
shooting it like a film. I think that's really cool. And yeah, like you said, about 10 minutes later when Harry actually gets the tapes and starts, like, you know, hearing parts that don't work. As I was watching it, it was like, that part doesn't work, and then he rewinds it. I'm like, ooh, what are you gonna do, Harry? And then he like changes like which tape he's listening to. I'm like, oh shit, that's awesome. And it's just so, and yeah, that sort of gets his colleagues later as well. Like, they thought that was super impressive.
Oh yeah, no,
and,
for sure.
And yeah, no, I think that's great, and I love the way they do that scene. And I think it's good. I like the two actors in the conversation as well. I think that woman's adorable.
And the dude looks like Tom Hardy.
Does it? Okay.
A lot.
I didn't notice that.
Like, weirdly, like in 70s Tom Hardy.
All right. I do want to watch this again, so I'll look for it. So okay. He looks like Tom Hardy in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, maybe.
Maybe. I can see that.
And then, like you said, the reveal. And just sort of, I'm totally fine with how often that conversation comes back. I feel like that scene is good enough that throughout the movie, you can deal with hearing it over and over again. Her being like, oh, God.
Yeah. And the, you get into his head really well when, you know, he's editing it and putting it all together to try to make it, you know, sound perfect. Mm. He re-listens to a certain sentence over and over, and it changes. Mm-hmm. Like, he, you know, you can hear him wanting to hear different things and putting different emphases on different words. And it's quite obvious that it's different audio recordings.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, we're just seeing this, we're hearing this through his ears pretty much. And you're seeing how kind of deep into it he's going. He's starting to hear things and, like, this paranoia and, like, it kind of gets maniacal about it at a point. And, you know, I thought that was cool the way they did that.
Okay.
And, with spy movies, like, I mean, we've talked about the Bourne movies and stuff before. I think I mentioned it then, but I love all that little stuff about, like, exactly how they do what they do. And, like, they get the mime to go up and stand by them for a bit. And then, you know, it all comes together in that scene we're talking about where he edits it, but edits it all together. But it's that stuff about, you know, there's always got to be someone nearby, someone aimed. Like, if they're going to turn, this guy gets it, then the guy on the bench gets it, and then you pass it off to Gene Hackman's character who gets it. Like, just the depth of how good he is at what he does, and, like, the breakdown and getting that very technical side of things. I really, really like that.
Yeah. And like you said, or like we said, I suppose, the reveal of that line, he'd kill us if he had the chance, turns out to be them sort of justifying the fact that they're going to murder her husband, as opposed to them being worried that her husband is going to murder them.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. And like I said, oh shit, when he was editing the those tapes at the beginning, I did the same thing for this because I did not remember that. And I was like, yeah.
And you hear that line about probably 5 minutes into the movie, and then
exactly.
You hear it over and over, and it's like the foundation that this whole movie's based on, and then they turn it on you at the end, and yes, very cool.
Yeah, and I mean, when thinking about it, like, how many other ways could it have gone? You know, like, there are two options with this line, right?
But it still works.
Oh, no, it's awesome.
100%.
It's awesome. It's just sort of something that I feel like maybe I should have figured out.
Yeah.
Particularly having seen the movie before.
I think it kind of flew in under the radar because it came out the same year as The Godfather, by Coppola.
Yeah, so good year.
Yeah, but I mean, understandable why this one kind of gets less notice.
Yeah, well, it was also nominated for Best Picture. It was a part of the five movies John Cazale was in, five or six, that all got nominated for Best Picture. Pretty good work. But I mean, and all the movies are good. Yeah, and it came out in April that year, and then The Godfather came out in November, probably. So it was just sort of like, it was a well-liked movie, but this always sort of feels like if you watch this and then The Godfather 2 it's really easy to see which one more people would latch on to.
Yeah.
This movie was not a box office failure, but this movie was not The Godfather 2.
No.
And yeah, and it, that was such a stacked time for American cinema as well that, yeah, this is sort of one that sort of gets lost in the shuffle. I think it's a great movie. I would love it if more people knew it.
Yeah, and it's not a movie I would really recommend to everybody, but mm-hmm. if you like kind of that era of mm-hmm. movies, I think this one, you know, does the 70s, like, quieter, kind of more character-driven movie.
Yeah, it's sort of like you can throw it in with, like, Taxi Driver and, what's the other one that I think, like, sort of this famous type of character study. That's going to bother me when I think of it, because I know I love the movie. Anyways, yeah, and there's I get a little bit of All the President's Men out of it as well, which I feel like you haven't seen, right?
Correct.
But you know,
I've seen some of the President's Men.
I've seen Duho, but not Robert Redford. Yeah, and I get a little bit of that. And yeah, no, I think it's a really good movie. And I think it's Coppola's best movie.
I think Coppola said that too.
He has, yeah, it's his favorite movie, but yeah. Yeah. Cool. I think it's probably his best movie. But and I like the ending as well. Like I like when he's freaking out in the hotel room and when the toilet starts overflowing, I'm like, what?
Yeah.
I don't know how that was possible, but what?
I think that's him going crazy.
Okay. See, all right, that's fair. I see that.
Oh, I think that's what that is for sure. And I usually don't like that.
Yeah. Well, then that's what the nightmare is for. It's to implant that this could happen.
I don't know. That whole sequence really bugs me. But I usually don't like when it gets that nutty over this is paranoia, like he's starting to see things.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, want to listen to my Scream 3 podcast? I touch on it a little bit.
Did we do a whole episode on Scream 3?
No.
That movie sucks. So if you want to listen to a podcast that's about a movie that's the exact opposite of the conversation and that it's terrible.
All right, Enemy of the State?
Well, I have one more question for you, because this is something I was trying to figure out, and yes. I'm curious about it. There's a lot of, in the movie, The Conversation, there's a lot of sort of framing Harry Call in front of or behind or, you know, just around various levels of transparency of glass.
Yeah.
And it sort of, it goes with his transparent raincoat or translucent raincoat, I suppose. And I'm just sort of curious as to what you think that means, because it has to mean something.
I think it's kind of the same thing with the cage. I think it's just another visual thing of him being separated from everybody. Okay. I mean, he sees everything mm-hmm. and, you know, he hears everything. That's very much what his character does. He's all about observing, but not really interacting with.
Okay.
And that's, you know, when he says, like, oh, I don't care what they're talking about. I just want a big fat recording. Like, I think that is his personality to a T. He does not interact. He's a fly on the wall. He observes. He, you know, gets the recording. He gets whatever people ask from him, but he doesn't want to be involved with anybody. He's so guarded. I think there's just, he exists in this world, but he's separate from everybody, and he does everything he can to stay separate from, you know, everybody else. He knows a lot about people. Mm-hmm. You know, he studies people. He you know, tries to figure out the way they think and act so he can get these recordings and get the information people require from him.
Mm-hmm.
But he does everything he can to separate himself. And I think that's what those kinds of shots show, that he is always separated from everything.
Yeah, and I think it sort of shows a level of knowledge that he has about the situation that's going on as well. I'd be curious to rewatch it again. I kind of want to do rewatch it again just to see, like, because there's various parts of the movie where he's more confused, and I'd be curious to see if the glass is even harder to see. Like the part on the hotel balcony, that glass is really, really hard to see through, and he sees so little. And he's extremely confused at that point. And I feel like maybe there's, you know, there's a variation on how confused he is as to how thick the glass is. And
yeah, that would actually be pretty cool to see.
Yeah.
This was my first time watching it this time through, so I didn't, you know, kind of have those things in mind that you look for in a rewatch. But yeah, that could be very interesting.
Yeah. So yeah, let's move on to Enemy of the State, directed by everybody's favorite, like basically our generation's Francis Ford Coppola, Tony Scott.
I don't think that's a fair assessment.
No. Well, calling him our generation isn't a fair assessment.
Okay.
Yeah, I like Tony Scott more than most people though, but anyway.
Okay. I liked Enemy of the State a lot.
Yeah, it's a very good movie. It's sort of, it fits really well into those, Bruckheimer and like the movies Bruckheimer influenced from the mid to late 90s, that it's just before CGI takes over. Basically everything from Bad Boys to Armageddon, Armageddon sort of being the end, and that's sort of where we get away from sort of human conflicts. Like, I mean, Armageddon's about people, but the villain is a rock. Yes. And as opposed to The Rock, where the villain is a human. And debatably, there is no villain, but...
Say The Rock again.
The Rock.
Played by The Rock.
Anyways, yeah, and it's just sort of... It's a good time for action movies. I mean, part of that is that we were the proper age to love those action movies at the time. But even going back and rewatching, I feel like Enemy of the State, not everything held up, but... Because, I mean, I couldn't tell you the last time I saw it. It's plausible that it's been a decade, but... Yeah, I think this movie really held up, and it is a movie that I saw so many times when I was really young that I feel like my opinion on film is very much influenced by this movie, and as a person, I'm very much influenced by this movie. I think it's very good, and I would watch it again.
I didn't see this until very recently, so I don't have that kind of connection with it where it kind of. When you see something when you're young, as we've discussed a lot, that kind of shapes your taste, so you kind of like it forever, whether it was good or bad.
You certainly recognize the type of movie, though. Tom Sizemore.
I just saw this for the first time, and I really liked it. Yeah. There are certainly things that don't make sense.
Oh, there's plenty that don't make sense.
There's big leaps in logic that you come to expect from action movies and stuff like that, but overall, I think it's a really good movie.
Yeah, I think a lot of the leaps in logic, though, are kind of, and this is sort of, I feel like this is the way I always saw it, because a lot of the leaps in logic have to do with the things that the NSA is able to do.
Yeah.
And I sort of feel like, because, I don't think a version of the act that they were trying to, that the government, John Voight's character, is trying to get passed, I don't think a version of that existed in 1998. Do you know?
I don't know. Okay. And that's something I want to talk about at the end when we compare the two, because...
Because my point about how the NSA is sort of jumping, like, doing all of these ludicrous things, I think the idea is sort of, like, just to sort of get you more concerned about what could happen. It's sort of like, they can't do this now. This is ridiculous now. But in 10 years, it seems like I feel like most of the technology in Enemy of the State... that seemed ridiculous.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of it probably exists now.
Yeah, no, and I was reading... I mean, they had someone who worked in... Not for the NSA, but someone who worked with very cutting-edge technology as one of the consultants on this movie. Yeah,
technical advisor.
Yeah, and I think they said, like, look, this is cool. Like, some of this is absolutely spot on, but a lot of this is a stretch.
Yeah.
And the way that they were pinpointing them in some of the chase sequences with the satellite right away and intercepting calls and, like, connecting everything like that...
And the way the camera rotates when they're looking at the bag, that's just impossible.
The Matrix thing, yeah. They said, like, this is not true. This technology does not exist. But yeah, as you said, I think at this point, like, the fact that I can do a lot of this stuff on Google Earth with a cheap laptop, like, think of what the NSA or some government agency we don't even know about can do at this point, right?
That's why I think the movie's interesting, and more so than the majority of those 90s action movies. And that's why I feel like this movie really holds up, is that... even apart, like, if you hated this as an action movie, I feel like there are interesting themes, if nothing.
Yeah, no, that's what I was going to say. I mean, it's a good action movie, but I think it's thematically, it's definitely got a lot going on for it to think about. I was just watching, like, just when I sat down to watch it and all the credits were coming up. What an exciting cast.
Yeah. It's pretty great. It's very, very 90s cast.
Yeah, like Jack Black and Seth Green not annoying me at all. Like, just being funny and awesome.
Yeah. No, has Seth Green ever annoyed you? He's awesome.
Probably at some point.
And this is, like, right towards the beginning of him on Buffy as well. So he's, like, at the height of his 90s powers.
Yeah.
90s powers. Yeah. Well, you don't see him in things anymore,
Yeah.
Like, I mean, he by choice, but anyways.
But yeah, there's that credit sequence, and then right off the bat,
I mean, let's just go through some of the people. We've got Jack Black, Seth Green, John Voight.
Well, I want to stop you on John Voight for a bit to talk about that opening sequence.
We'll come back to it. Okay, okay. We've got Jason Robards, awesome. Speaking of the opening sequence, we've got...
Wait, why do you like Jason Robards so much?
Because he's just a cool guy. Okay. Like, his voice is awesome. He's the editor in All the President's Men.
Okay, that'll help.
He's very good in this movie. He's Tom Cruise's dad in Magnolia.
So he is.
Yeah. No, he's got a good career. Yeah, where was I? We got Jake Busey. We got Scott Kahn. We've got Scott Kahn's haircut. We've got
Will Smith and Gene Hackman.
Yeah, Will Smith, Gene Hackman. I figured that
those are big. But
we've got Anna Gunn of Breaking Bad.
Oh my god, I groaned so loudly when she showed up.
Regina Hall, Lisa Bonet, just so many people.
Oh, what's his face?
Yep.
No, the one of the bad guys.
Tom Sizemore.
No, although I like
and
that.
All of Tom Sizemore's goons who are in all the other Bruckheimer movies in the 90s is awesome.
No, one of the guys who does, one of the guys who, actually, one of the bad guys who goes up to Will Smith and Pepper?
Oh, Barry Pepper.
Barry Pepper. Yeah. I love Barry Pepper.
Oh, he's great. He's a good actor.
Big fan of him. Yeah. And I saw him, I was like, yes, another guy sneaking in there.
Yeah.
But yeah, just to go back to the start, that opening sequence where kind of lays down the whole plot of the movie.
Yeah.
John Voight works for the NSA, and he wants this legislation passed by Robarts, who's a congressman on his way out. And basically, it's kind of like the Patriot Act before the Patriot Act. No, it's like, let's give the government unlimited powers to listen to all communication.
Yeah.
Again, this is 3 years before 9/11, 3 or 4 years before the Patriot Act. Did you know the Patriot Act stands for something?
What, like it's an acronym?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
It just sounds...
Providing authorities with the tools and resources to intercept and obstruct terrorism.
Jeez.
That's awesome, eh? Like, I don't like the Patriot Act, but I love when...
Yeah, I feel weird calling anything about the Patriot Act awesome.
Patriot Act high five!
No. The government does not endorse the Patriot Act.
But yeah, so he's kind of... He wants, you know, a precursor to the Patriot Act before we knew about it. Congressman... Not down with this idea.
No.
And so they kill him.
Yeah. And I mean, this is sort of like a very ideal type of congressman in that he's like, whatever money you'll lose.
Yeah.
Whatever money you'll lose. John Voight says this, whatever money you'll lose, I'll more than make up for it. And he's like, it's not about the money. It's about my constituents.
All the jobs that I'm going to lose.
Yeah, exactly.
Or my constituents would lose.
So he has to die.
Yeah, so they kill him.
Yeah. Oh, Jason Lee, that's another guy we forgot. Anyways, continue. Yeah.
And so they kill him, and this is how evil, like, I love evil John Voight.
That is
awesome. I really do like evil John Voight, except in Anaconda. But, like, with the sad...
We have to make sure that people know you don't like Anaconda. Like,
not that I don't like Anaconda. Have you watched that movie?
I've never seen
it. Oh my god.
Why would I watch that piece of shit?
Okay, just watch a clip and listen to John Voight's accent in that.
You've told me about
wonderful.
This
But yeah, like, he's so evil, he makes a dog, like, cry in the first 2 minutes of a movie. Like, that is an evil dude. Like, a beautiful golden lab must cry. Yeah, that was just how evil that guy is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then they kill him, and then... Game on.
Yep. And we get sort of that opening credit sequence is very I really thought it was effective at the time when I was younger. I think less so now, but I feel like that's really where we get a lot of modern Tony Scott. Just for people that are interested in the career of Tony Scott like I am, that's sort of where he really starts going a little bit crazy with the editing, and we get a little bit more of that in Spy Game. Spy Game's very restrained by Tony Scott standards, but I think the movie that follows up after that is Man on Fire, which is fucking crazy. And I feel like a lot of the ideas that are there in Man on Fire, come from that opening credit sequence. Yeah. No. Let's not talk about that.
Just one more thing I want to talk, a weird, another 9/11 connection.
Yeah.
Did you catch John Voight's character's birthday?
Yeah, it's 9/11/40. And I think that was sort of the, that was also September 11th, 1940 was apparently the day a first remote computer connection happened.
Yes.
So I think that's, you know.
Yeah, no, it was just another
little thing. Yeah, it's just a coincidence, yeah.
But yeah, it was the first remote operation of a computer, and obviously we have, you know, a lot of that going on.
I just didn't want you going all Alex Jones on me.
No.
I know he's logical, but I want to make sure.
Yeah, and I guess what had happened was Jason Lee's character,
you mentioned. Daniel Zavitz.
Yeah, I was filming this murder.
Yep.
Accidentally.
The box is called a hide.
I'm not gonna dwell on this too long, but it's kind of funny when he gets hit by a fire truck, right?
No, I see that.
Like, it's the whole music's like swelling, like he just got away on the bike, like just out of their reach. It's this amazing, like, you know, this crazy sequence and this crazy chase, and he's finally getting away, and then what? Yeah. Just gets wrecked.
Yeah, and it doesn't really make sense why he feels the need to cross lanes either, but whatever. Yeah, he has to die, so he dies.
Yeah, and he does. And that's when they're on to Will Smith now.
It's pronounced Robert Clayton Dean.
Robert.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yep.
Three first names?
No, the Clayton's in the middle. He's a lawyer, so he has to sound as professional. Robert Dean sounds more like a person. Robert Clayton Dean sounds like a lawyer.
Right. Okay, so we'll go two first names. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we talked about that chase sequence. The ending of this movie, and by the ending, I mean like 45 minutes, is pretty nonstop action.
Yep. Yeah, pretty much once Will Smith, Dean meets Brill. Well, I mean, the second time he meets Brill. Once they meet on the ferry, it's pretty much, this is starting, and we're done here. You know, like, it's pretty good.
Yeah. I'm assuming you really like Gene Hackman in this one as well.
I like him a lot.
Yeah, I think he's very good at this.
Yeah.
It's very enjoyable. It looks like my dad, but that's not why I like him.
Okay, that's fair. but yeah, no, it's, he's very good and very, I don't know, he's having fun with it as well. Like, it's really clear that he's having fun. And
why'd you blow up the building?
Because you made a phone call. And the part where they're having pretty soon after that, when they're eating together, when he's just chewing and he's like, "You want to take a poke at me?" Like, I just think the way he says that's so funny.
Yeah. And again, I mean, I talked about this earlier. I really love that kind of very technical, very like specific how these guys do what they do, how these spies and surveillance people do what they do. When they break into his house.
Yes.
And, you know, they have the footage of him using a Montblanc pen, so they get a bugged Montblanc pen. You know, they put, like, six different trackers on him, and then Gene Hackman uses all his know-how and, like, puts all those tracers in a chip bag to mess up the signals and stuff like that. Like, I'm just so...
And then they reuse those tracers.
Yeah, exactly. I am so big on, like, that stuff, and this movie had a bunch of it, and I was very, very pleased about it.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
I know you sometimes begrudgingly bring up Michael Bay and regret it immediately because you say it too much. Do you think Tony Scott gets away with a lot of Michael Bay stuff? Like a lot of, I saw the average length of the shot in this movie, I think was 2.4 seconds, which is short. No. Kind of glossing over logic for the sake of action and pacing and stuff like that. We talked about before how kind of Michael Bay gets... kind of painted with this brush and kind of is the sacrificial lamb for all these action-y movies that don't make a lot of sense and that are too popcorn. How does Tony Scott get away from that? Because I feel like a lot of his
Think he does. No? And I feel like Tony Scott is sort of similarly hated, maybe even more so, because I see the criticisms for Michael Bay and a lot of them make sense. Mm-hmm. A lot of the Tony Scott criticisms don't. Like, Tony Scott's filmography is not stellar, as far as percentage-wise. But I think, like, the thing that really bothers me is that Tony Scott seems to be hated by a lot of people, and Ridley Scott isn't, despite the fact that Ridley Scott's two good movies are better than anything Tony Scott will ever make,
right.
Being Alien and Blade Runner, and hopefully Prometheus is really good. But,
Monopoly.
But
Monkey Travel.
The thing is, Tony Scott's made more good movies than Ridley Scott has, because pretty much everything Ridley Scott's made outside of those two movies sucks.
Okay.
And I feel like Ridley Scott has gotten a pass just because, you know, he made Blade Runner in 1982, it wasn't even good on the first pass, you know? Like, and Tony Scott's made Enemy of the State, good movie. Man on Fire is a good movie.
That's a pretty good movie.
Unstoppable, that last one he did with Denzel Washington and Chris Pine, that was good.
Deja Vu is a fun ride.
Yeah, Deja Vu is good. I feel like you'd hate Deja Vu a lot more now if you watch it again.
Okay.
But I like Deja Vu more than most people. You know, he made True Romance.
Good.
Yeah, exactly. Like, right there, we've got five movies. Regardless what you think about Top Gun, it's a very, striking piece of filmmaking.
Those are all, like, 7-8 movies, like, out of 10.
What do you Oh, yeah.
8
yeah.
out of 10.
Yeah, yeah.
I think everyone would probably give most of those a 7.5 at least.
Exactly. They're just, like, they're entertaining movies. Yeah. Like, the Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 is sort of where we all of Tony Scott's criticism was correct, because that movie was awful.
Okay.
In a way that made me feel sick. Like, there were so many rotating cameras, like rotating across different axes during just conversation scenes. And it just I felt like I was going to vomit, which is only the second time that's happened in a movie.
Yeah. I was going to say, you're not the type to be like, oh, Cloverfield, the camera was shaky, I'm going to puke. Like,
no, it's like,
you're very forgiving on moving cameras and things like that.
Yeah, and James Gandolfini played the mayor of New York, and there's just this one scene where he's standing and the camera is sort of like rotating around him very quickly, but they did it two separate times, and they did once with the camera rotating clockwise and the other time with the camera rotating counterclockwise, and they intercut it, and it was so bizarre. Yeah. Like, it was terrible. But anyways, yeah, Tony Scott, I feel like it's a lot of crap that he doesn't deserve, and I think he's a better director than most people think. Similar to Michael Bay, but I feel like Michael Bay's style is still more in your face than Tony Scott's. Just because you don't get as many moving cameras in Tony Scott. You get a lot more static shots. Whereas Michael Bay, if the camera's moving, not moving in a shot, then that's odd.
Right. We talked about this briefly with what satellites are actually capable of.
Yes. And the answer is not that.
Not that. But I did really like how much they used kind of those satellite views, like those high up views, like for a lot of the chase sequences and stuff when they're running from building to building.
Yeah.
Just kind of like similar to the way that, that scene, that shot at the end of the conversation has that side to side sort of surveillance thing.
Or the very opening shot of the conversation as
well. Exactly. I did enjoy that, kind of the use of that, the satellite shots. And, you know, I like when, I've said this before, but like when all the themes kind of show up visually and things like that. It wasn't just the like, oh, let's see what the satellite sees, and they show that, but like, you know, cut into the chases, we get shots like that, and I really enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anything else you liked about this movie in particular?
A lot. I think it's a really effective action movie. I feel like the emotional swells of the movie work really well. Like, I think it's got a good score, and there's just that moment where they're running after they lose the disc, pretty much immediately after, and they're sort of running across that just sort of, I can't even call it a field because there's no nature there, but it's just like a pit, I guess, running towards the train, and the helicopter's chasing them, and Gene Hackman's about to fall in front of the train, and just the way the score is, and they're so hopeless at that moment, and I think it's this really good moment of just like, wow, these guys, like, they're in it, and they're screwed. And I think that's a really effective moment. And from that point on, they sort of take charge. And I think it's cool. I think it's clearly implausible how the ending plays out, how Dean is able to sort of get these two people in a room and with very vague conversation. I don't think it's totally implausible that the way Dean acts and survives, which, by the way, is another thing I think is really cool. Our hero doesn't pick up a gun in the final action sequence.
That's true. I didn't even think about that.
And that's something I've always liked about the movie. One thing I don't like about the movie is when he does pick up a gun in the chase scene. But and I think that's really cool. And I feel like him hiding under the table, I buy that. I feel like he could survive that gunfight under a table. It's unlikely, but I feel like that's a 50-50 gamble that he's making, and it's a better chance than him picking up a gun, as we see, because one person survives and he's paralyzed.
Anything else to say about that?
They repeat shots in this movie, and I hate it.
Okay.
Did you notice this?
No, I don't think so.
In the opening credit sequence, we get that shot of the guy. It's the only shot that's not, like, a surveillance camera, but of a guy sitting in front of all these, TVs, and he's just watching all these surveillance cameras. And then we get that shot later in the movie when Will Smith's in the tunnel, and they call the tunnel guy. That's that guy. And they repeat the exact shot. There's a part where there are two parts, I guess, but sort of one part where Fiedler, Jack Black's character, says it's already done, then closes the cell phone. They use that two times from a separate angle, and like once early on and then later just on a separate angle. And then they used when towards the end when Will Smith or Dean is like in front of a hotel door, it's like the same. I don't know if it's the exact same shot. Like, I was trying to figure this out because he might be wearing different clothes, but it's basically the exact same thing. Where it's like, come on, open the door. And Gene Hackman's like working the door thing, just like Scott Conn or whoever takes the thing from him was. And it's just so close to earlier in the movie when he's like waiting for Mr. Wu to open the door.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I can't believe you can get away with doing that.
Yeah.
And it makes me really upset. Like, I'm not dumb enough that this will get past me.
Yeah, that kind of stuff usually bugs me, but I don't even know if I noticed. So
maybe
that's how they get away with it.
These are things I noticed like the first time I saw it. I remember being like, "You can reuse a shot in a movie that you've already used, like it's
and not for artistic purposes, like
yeah,
the conversation no. repeats certain things.
Exactly.
Yeah,
no, it's just like convenience. And man, that bothered me at the time. And yeah, I will defend Tony Scott. I will never defend that.
Okay. Do you want to talk about kind of the connections between these movies?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely, I do.
Because I think that's, like, I watched these two movies, like one day after the other. So they're both very fresh in my mind when I watch them. And they're not, I mean, it's not a sequel, or it's not billed as such, but it kind of is.
not a sequel, no, but,
different director.
Thematic cousins.
Yeah, and I mean, we got Gene Hackman, he plays characters by different names and who seem to have, somewhat different histories.
Well, I think the history that we get for Brill, sort of places him somewhere that Call couldn't have been.
Exactly, time, yeah. Yeah. But it's there. I mean,
yeah. Oh yeah, no.
I know I'm not the first one to notice this or say it, but you know, maybe he's got a pseudonym, maybe he's lying at one point in the story, but
yeah, no, and it's
the way that these movies share a lot of the same themes. This character, you know, he's got the know-how, he's kind of got the same attitude, you know, pretty guarded. He kind of has that one character that he knew, Rachel's dad who died, and that's, you know, it seems like, you know, if these really are sequels, maybe he did let his guard down a little bit, became friends with somebody, and then he died, and, you know, it totally burned him. Like, the thing that he hoped wouldn't happen really did, and now he's back in the shit again in this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, even aside from that, they're, like, this movie goes out of its way to have things that are, like, exactly like the conversation.
Like what?
The conversation. Like that scene where Lisa Bonet's character, Rachel, and Dean meet in the square, I think Mount Vernon Square. That's staged to look like the conversation. The way they just sort of walk in circles and then sit on a bench, walk in circles. And, like, even one of the guys following them has like a paper shopping bag with a mic in it, just like one of the guys in the conversation. And I think that's a really cool scene. They shoot through the trees and stuff. The way it's actually shot is the same.
Yeah.
I like that. And I mean, even when they're bugging Dean earlier on, you know, the pen tracer, or the pen mic, which is or the pen tracer in this movie, like the pen mic and the conversation, and also they sort of they make sort of like the subtle play on that line the rotund gentleman with the mustache says when he's like, or when they say they can't bug the clothes because you have no idea what they're gonna wear. They make sure they know what Dean's gonna wear, and then they bug his clothes.
Yeah,
and I think that's really cool.
That's
something really subtle that I liked a lot.
Yeah, I like that.
But there's, you know, more obvious things.
Yeah,
but
I like the idea that Brill, Gene Hackman's character, is like so good at hiding and being undercover that even the movies he's in don't know that they're sequels to each other. That's the way that I take it. Just to compare the two of them, I mean,
well, in The Cage, obviously The Cage, but
for sure. Yeah, and he even said, like, it's not even as though they just show the cage, like, it's mentioned and discussed why it works that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, to compare these, this was 1974 to 1998.
Yep.
And I mentioned that it is a very, I felt at least, that The Conversation is a very 70s movie.
Yes.
And I would say that this is, I mean, we talked about it, this is a very 90s movie, too.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's sort of like, it's a bit ahead of its time. With some parts, I think, the Patriot Act, and like I was rereading over some of the surveillance aspects of the Patriot Act on Wikipedia for this, and Enemy of State is very prescient that way.
Yeah.
Go
ahead.
Yeah, but the other thing about Enemy of State is that this is 1998, late 1998. I think it came out in November. And this is when, you know, technology, fear of technology is getting kind of high with the Y2K just around the corner. I thought that was kind of interesting. And I couldn't find sort of like a date for when the Y2K scare really began. Like, I was just so young, I can't remember. I know it existed and I know it was stupid even when I was 14. But I couldn't find an exact date. I feel like this movie was in production before that. But similar to the conversation, which is very much kind of about Watergate, without, according to Coppola, intending to be. Yeah, I think it's just sort of very timely movie, even in a way it didn't intend.
Yeah, and that's the thing about both of these movies. They were both, like, just a couple years ahead of their time.
Yeah.
You know, you can say what you want about the way that they were made, but, I mean, just the subject matter.
Yeah.
A couple years. I mean, they said that they really started developing the conversation in the 60s. It came out just as Watergate was really breaking, and some of the technology that they were using, I guess, was some of the stuff that helped, you know, Watergate be Watergate.
Mm-hmm.
Came out in 74, and I mean, this was just as, you know, Watergate was a very big deal.
Yeah, I think Nixon resigned in, like, late 74.
Yeah.
Like, he was still the president, but, you know.
The trial, well, not the trial, I think, but, it was, like, everything was, you know, coming to the forefront.
Yeah, 72, I think, was the big year as far as, like, exposed.
Yeah, that's when the break-in actually was.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and then this one, as we said, like, it's very 9/11-y. Like, yeah. It's so much of this stuff, like, if this
more
came
post 9/11.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's not so much about the attacks, but I mean, it's about the effects of it. It's kind of like, you know, like the Bourne stuff we talked about. It's, you know, we have to be on defense now, but let's not let all this stuff, you know, totally taint our civil liberties and take those away.
Allegedly, actually, or apparently, and I mean, I found this a couple places, but no source I really trust. The most trustworthy source was Wikipedia without a citation. But Tony Gilroy, who was sort of like the main writer behind at least the story of the Bourne movies, and he wrote the script for the first two and the story for the third, did a rewrite on Enemy of the State.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Same with Aaron Sorkin, apparently.
Yeah, and I saw that
they were both in the Bruckheimer stable as far as doing rewrites around that time. Gilroy did an extensive rewrite on Armageddon as well, and Aaron Sorkin worked on The Rock.
But, okay,
yeah.
So how do you feel about how these movies depict technology?
How do you mean? I like the way they depict technology, but I do not like the technology they depict.
Yeah, that's what I guess that's kind of what I'm getting at. I mean, in the conversation, I think it's kind of seen as a neutral tool. I mean, the way that Gene Hackman talks about it, it's like, oh, I'm going to record, but I have nothing to do with it. Like, yes. He seems to try to separate himself from it. Technology in this case is kind of like anything. Like, it can be used for good or bad.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he tries to separate himself from it and be like, oh, okay, well, I'm using it, but it's I'm not doing anything with it. I'm procuring it and I'm giving it out, but I'm not acting on this in any way. Whereas I feel with Enemy of the State, it's painted a bit more negatively.
Yes.
Like these, you know, just the idea of the law that's trying to be passed or whatever act was, you know, what they're talking about in the first scene. Like
Security Invasions and Privacy Act, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, this is a bad thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I think we are supposed to, because we are supposed to see John Voight as a villain, we're supposed to be in that congressman's shoes, the one who dies right off the bat. And it's, you know, this is bad, not just because it loses jobs for my constituents, but as we see in the rest of the film, it really breaches privacy.
Yep.
And even when these things are illegal, there are still people. I mean, that's the thing about John Voight's character is not acting in the law.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's rogue.
Yep.
And you see that at the end when they're like, if this is a legit op, that's fine. But yeah. I feel like it's not.
Yeah.
I feel like that's them kind of speaking to technology and all this kind of surveillance technology. Like, this is inherently bad. Like,
yeah.
If we're going to spy on people this much, that is a bad thing.
Yeah. The conversation is very much about how you use surveillance. And it's sort of like, it's very, you have to be really cautious about how it's used. And the conversation is very, I mean, it's a very sort of don't trust the government type of way, because, you know, like, we get this sort of nameless character named the director, played by Robert Duvall, in the conversation. And,
yeah.
And you know, he's sort of like the head of a company, and we really can't trust, like, we're unsure of how he's using the surveillance.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't trust it, but you can still sort of use surveillance in a correct way, I guess, for Harry Potter.
Yeah, the one part that I really laughed about, and this was even before I saw Enemy of the State and didn't have a chance to contrast the two, but the convention scene and all the stuff about the convention, like, it seemed very, I'm not even sure the word, but very, like, neutered. Like, it's just, it's one of those things. It's the way that you would have a convention about, you know, like toilet paper or like a new pen or like anything, right? Like it's just, this is a new thing. Like there's the same people, like, you know, they have their different stands and this guy's, oh, the older guy who has his old stuff. Yeah. And like, it seems very, like very separate from the nefarious things that you could get up to with it. You know, there's like, oh, like you remember how drunk you got at the last convention and like, you know,
no, it's supposed to be just like work.
Exactly. It's just like any other thing that you would have a work convention about, you know, like it's insurance sales, it's blah, 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 it's whatever. And I feel like that's really gone by the time we get to the end.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's 24 years later and technology is significantly more advanced. And that's part of the reason why I like Enemy of the State. I feel like a lot of the things, and the last thing we get in the movie is that congressman the guy that was, you know, trying to pass the bill, not John Voight, but John Voight was sort of, you know, like trying to get this guy votes.
Yeah.
We see him on Larry King. And the last thing we hear in the movie is Larry King saying, well, you have the no right to enter my home. Like, we've got to protect the sanctity of my home.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the point of the movie, is that like this privacy is sort of disappearing. And it's sort of why, like, when people use their phone, like friends of mine, like my roommate, use their phone like on Foursquare to check in where they are. I'm like, why? That is terrible. That's awful. That's like, hey, America, or sorry, Canada, this is where I am currently. You can find me here. Yeah. Like, why? Why would you do this? And like this Rogers thing, and this Rogers thing that they have now, like this home security system that will send you a text message when your kids get home from school.
Yeah.
Like, that's terrifying to me.
Yeah, and there's that shot.
And it's not sort of even like that technology specifically. It's that we're allowing this. Like, what's next? You know, like, what are we just going to blindly be like, okay, that's fine. That's not weird. No, that's not fucking weird that I get a fucking text message when my kids get home from school and they don't have to call me.
Yeah, no, Jesus, there's that one shot in that. I know exactly the Rogers commercial you're talking about.
I haven't seen the commercial, but like, I was doing a shoot. Or, like, this thing where Rogers employees were talking about it. I was like, that's real?
Yeah.
Like, we were with Graham, our friend Graham, and I, like, turned to him and was like, is this a real thing? And he didn't know either. And, like, I was more alarmed just because that's the nature of our personalities. But, was dumbfounded for the entire day.
There's this shot in the commercial where the daughter comes home. It's, like, you know, like a 10-year-old girl. I was, like, coming home from school. Closes the door behind her and just looks up into the mirror, like into the camera in the corner, like in the roof of her home, and like waves. And then the dad's at the airport, like looking at it on a smartphone, and like it seems so Orwellian. Like, it just seems like a 1984 thing. Like,
it is.
That's a commercial. No, but that's what I mean. Like, it just seems like a commercial you would put in that, and it seemed like.
It seems like something that should be a joke.
Yeah, or a joke, or like a cautionary tale. Like, this is what we're getting to if things keep continuing down this trail. And it's like, yeah, we're there. it's not a cautionary tale. It's a fact. This is what happens now.
It's so upsetting.
Yeah.
And that's why I like Enemy of the State, because I hate
Oh, I hate do you everything. Like the poster?
Poster, sure. No, I'm just too sad.
Okay.
The Enemy of the State poster, where it's sort of like...
Yeah,
it's, like yeah, it's a good poster, cool. For sure. That's why I like... these movies, I enjoy all the sort of like distrust of the government with the conversation, particularly that it was released around Watergate time. You know, Coppola says it's not about Watergate, but I think the way this movie is, I feel like it's a movie that could have been put together quickly. Sort of like Inception, or sort of like Nolan was after Batman Begins. He's like, okay, I've got time to do the Prestige. I feel like that's sort of how the conversation could have fit in between the two Godfather movies.
Timely.
Yeah.
It's more timely than the Godfather movies.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. And I feel like I also believe that Coppola wrote it in the '60s, but, it's not implausible to me that he just says that. So to sort of take away. And,
yeah. And certain things can be tweaked and make a big difference.
And either way, it's like, regardless of his intention, it's about Watergate.
Yeah.
You know, no artist has control of that. Just like Enemy of the State is about parts of the Patriot Act that didn't exist when. Technology, I'm not afraid of technology. We're clearly fans of technology. What I'm afraid of is surveillance technology.
I hate technology. So follow us on Twitter.
Yeah. #surveillance.
I think that's it.
Yeah.
Wrap it up.
Yeah. Now I'm going to go cry in a corner for the rest of the day like Gene Hackman. But just assume I'm being surveilled.
But the government will see you while you do it.
Exactly. Play my saxophone. Anyways, thank you for listening to the government.
Thanks.
Yeah, we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com, or follow us on Twitter at @themacguffinmen.